WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave in for Terry Gross. What is it like to live in an Orthodox religious community that has intentionally cut itself off from the rest of the world? What would it be like to want to remain Orthodox, yet want to be more worldly as well? This is what Allegra Goodman explores in her new novel, Catterskill Falls. It's set in a community in New York's Catskill Mountains, where Orthodox Jews from the city come for the summer. In spite of the community's uniformity, there are religious conflicts between the generations and even between siblings. Allegra Goodman is also the author of The Family Markowitz, a humorous book about three generations of a Jewish middle-class family. Goodman is in her early 30s, lives in Boston, but grew up in Hawaii, where the Jewish community was very small. Terry Gross spoke with her recently. Here's a reading from her new novel. Elizabeth, who yearns to do things her community won't allow her to do, like run a business, is listening to the new rabbi preaching about the importance of remaining insulated from the outside world.
Before I read this, I'd just like to define a few of the words. The Rav means the rabbi. Drash is just another word for speech, his speech. And the word kahila is really the word for community. Shabbos is a word for Sabbath. The Rav's drash goes on and on. His voice is bright and strident, shrill, and he repeats himself often. Again and yet again, he underlines this point. There is no room for compromise. There is no sustenance outside the community. Our strength comes from within, from our own convictions, our own families, and our own institutions. There are those who argue for leniency, for making exceptions. There are those who maintain dealings and friendships with Jews who do not observe Shabbos, or who intermarry or eat treif. That's non-kosher food. What then is the message that they send to their children? That these people are still good? That they are still worthy of attention and uncritical friendship? This is what our children learn, that we will tolerate this kind of behavior. Is this the lesson we want to teach them? How then should we explain it? That it is wrong for us, but right for other people? Or that it is wrong for anyone, but that people who do wrong are still worthy of our respect and of our friendship? Is this what we want to teach? Only consistency will sustain us. Only consistent thoughts and actions will keep Judaism alive. Of course, Elizabeth has heard all this before. This is Rav Isaiah's first major drash, but the message is familiar. She is used to these formulations, and although she listens to them, she does not believe them. She has never seen the kahila as a fortress. Now, more than ever, the outside fascinates her. The people there, the way everyone moves about. The complexity of a world with such loose days and weeks, the time never delineated between work and Shabbos, the food never separated, the men and women mixed together as well. So many decisions made rather than received, where to live, what kind of work to do. She sees it now. It was never the poetry she was after, never the secular books, the paintings, or the plays. It was the diversity of choices, the quick and subtle negotiations of the outside world. Elizabeth listens to the Rav, but she hears him from a distance. Deep within her, she knows that she has scaled those bulwarks of which he speaks. She has scaled the kahila's wall and softly lowered herself down to the other side.
It interests me that you've chosen as your subject this very tight-knit Jewish community, an Orthodox fundamentalist Jewish community that wants to keep away from the rest of the world. They want to lock out the rest of the world. Whereas you grew up Jewish in Hawaii, in a place where there were very few other Jews, so you probably couldn't possibly have had that kind of community around you. Maybe you could talk a little bit about the contrast between where you grew up and the world that you've created in your novel.
Well, I did grow up in a much freer, more assimilated community, definitely. And in fact, most of the world is in that, grows up that way. And there were two things that inspired me to write about these people. And one reason was that they were exotic to me. When I was a small child growing up in Hawaii, my parents our whole family used to go in the summers to upstate New York, where my mother's family had a house. And there were Orthodox Jewish people and an Orthodox Jewish synagogue. And we used to be part of the summer community there. And I saw the people there, and it made a great impression on me. And so that was one of the things that inspired me. And the other was that artistically, the people that I'm inventing here are so principled, and they live lives of such structure that it gave me a stage in which to dramatize certain issues that interested me as a novelist. Issues about how individuals define themselves within a group, and how people face moral dilemmas. People who are very, very principled, how they face those dilemmas.
What was the Jewish community like in your part of Hawaii, and how much were you a part of that community?
Well, we were very active in the Jewish community. It was small. There was a Reform temple, and my parents, when they came out there, founded a small conservative synagogue, which held traditional conservative services. And when I was very, very little, I remember the services were held in a Quonset hut, and we used to hold them there. And so this is interesting, actually. When I was a child, we always came exactly on time to services. I was completely shocked when I became a grown-up and saw that everybody comes late to services here. But we always came on time because my father was usually leading one of the parts of the service. And, you know, they needed 10 men to start, and we didn't have, you know, all these extra people walking around. So later on, the services were held in a Unitarian church. And after that, they were held on Saturday mornings in the Reformed Temple because the sanctuary wasn't being used on Saturday mornings. They had Friday night services. And everybody knew everybody else, especially the people in this small group. And the children all knew each other. And I remember it as actually a lovely time. We used to go to picnics and have seders at each other's houses and all of that. It was very, very small.
Since your family co-founded this conservative synagogue, did that place you in a special position of responsibility to go to
yes.
Services?
Oh, yes. We were always there every week. Definitely.
And did you have to be the model child while you were there?
I don't think so. My parents would probably know the answer to that, but I don't remember feeling that I did have to. I mean, you know, my father isn't a rabbi, and in fact, we had no rabbi in the service, so it wasn't like sort of being the rabbi's daughter and sort of, you know, there was none of that formality.
Explain how there could be services without a rabbi.
Well, you don't need one. You just need 10 men, you know, to lead. We just had lay leaders lead the service, and one person read Torah, and one person, you know, the various parts of the service were divvied up. So there wasn't any need for a rabbi. And we didn't have any sermons either, of course. Maybe that was a good thing.
Was it everybody's dream to someday get a rabbi, or did people like the idea of this non-hierarchical service?
Well, of course, you know, as in any good Jewish community, there was a split about this. Some people liked the non-hierarchical service. Other people thought it should be more of an institution and have a rabbi. You know, it's always going to be like that.
What brought your parents to Hawaii?
Well, what brought them there was my father is a professor of philosophy, and he'd gotten a job in 1969 at the University of Hawaii. And so the job market being what it was, the academic job market, he took the job. And then my mother finished graduate school there and then also got a job at the university. And then they lived there 25 years.
And did you find that Jewish and Hawaiian customs mixed in the family in interesting and unusual ways?
Well, I don't know. We certainly had a little bit of a Hawaiian flavor to our lives in that, for one thing, I tell people some of my fondest memories of growing up in Hawaii was every Passover for our Seder, we had our Seder outside. So that was a little bit of Hawaii there. That's an unusual thing to do here on the mainland. And I did wear a muumuu when I had my bat mitzvah. That is definitely true. I don't know exactly, you know, what other customs we may have taken. Most Hawaiian food isn't kosher, so we weren't exactly, you know, going to luau's a lot. But living in Hawaii definitely influenced my family in some ways, and it's a beautiful, beautiful place, and we loved it there.
Did you keep kosher while you were in Hawaii?
Yes, we did. There's no kosher butcher there, so my parents used to order their kosher meat from a butcher in California. And it was shipped on a Matson ship and dropped off at the dock. They would get about 6 months' meat at a time. And my mother would drive the station wagon down to the dock and pick up all our meat. And we had an extra freezer. A few other families did this too. So, but we did.
Now, I believe your mother ended up heading the Women's Studies program at the University of Hawaii. How did she reconcile feminism and some of the more traditional aspects of Judaism in which, you know, women are not given equal status to men?
Well, she was an interesting woman. She was a feminist, definitely, and a remarkable career woman, real professional. And at the same time, she had a traditionalism within her, so that she was a terrific baker, for example. A lot of the food in my novel is based on her food. When I describe the rugelach that the people make, I drew from my own experience watching her make rugelach. And she was a tremendous baker. And so she was one of these feminist women who made cookies, you know. So she was not egalitarian in the sense that she felt that she had to go up and read Torah in the service. That wasn't her style so much. But again, she didn't live in a community the way Elizabeth lived in a community. So she, in such a tight-knit, constricted community. She lived a very modern life in an unusual place and did unusual things.
Now, your father wrote a book about Judaism, human rights, and human values. What were some of the main points you took from that?
I don't know if I took points directly from his book, but I've certainly been influenced by his ideas about Judaism and his conception of a liberal Judaism that embraces philosophy. He studies Jewish philosophy and is a Jewish philosopher, and he has an idea about that there is such a thing as Jewish thought and Jewish thinking about ideas, not just a Talmudic kind of Judaism, a scholastic sort of learning that goes on that the Rav engages in, for example, in my book, but a Judaism that embraces Western philosophy as well. So I think that ideal was something that perhaps I played off of in my novel with some of the characters who aspire to it or don't reach it. Perhaps that was an influence of mine.
Now, the Orthodox life that you write about in your new novel, Catterskill Falls, is a life that's really carved from another century. And it strikes me that in some ways your literary interests are from another century too, you know, specializing in Jane Austen and Shakespeare. What about writing of earlier centuries speaks to you? Its pacing is in some ways so different from writing today.
Oh, that's interesting. Well, I think this book in particular, this book was definitely influenced by some of the 19th century novelists like Jane Austen and George Eliot, Trollope, those Dickens, those people who wrote about a whole community and delineated and talked about the way individuals struggle to find a place in that community and developed a landscape. Its ambition is inspired by those brilliant novels in many ways. Now, I think that my pacing is quite a bit quicker than that of some of the 19th century novelists, and that my narrator is less obtrusive often. But so I don't really consider myself, you know, as living in the past in any way in this book. But I think that the kind of people that I was talking about, as you suggested, they live a life which is perhaps more 19th century than 20th century, and that their lives suggested a form that was inspired by that kind of literature. But I think that a different kind of people that I would write about might inspire a different kind of writing.
Terry's guest today is Allegra Goodman. Her new novel is Catterskill Falls. We'll hear more of their conversation after the break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, Terry's guest is writer Allegra Goodman. Her new novel is Catterskill Falls.
Writing seems to come easy to you. You wrote a whole collection of stories that were published while you were in college, and those stories ended up being your first book, your first collection called Total Immersion. But you write so well about somebody for whom nothing comes easy, and this is a description of the character Rachel in your new novel. She's a rabbi's daughter who becomes a rabbi's wife, and you write, nothing in life comes easily to Rachel. She struggles with herself. Even when she sits down at the piano, the music isn't relaxation for her. She practices relentlessly and with a kind of existential pessimism, believing that despite her skill, she will never really capture the soul of the music, and that for her, music will always be a discipline and not a gift. She believes this, although she plays beautifully. Again, since it seems that writing comes so naturally to you, how did you get such an insight into someone for whom music is such a struggle?
I guess I when I write about these characters, I just get inside. I just try to enter into them, and it doesn't seem hard to me. It's like being an actor or something, and I could feel her perfectionism crippling her, and I could feel it as I was writing it. It was it's hard to articulate, but that's how it was. It wasn't hard for me to write about that, and I perhaps deep inside of me, you know, I have some perfectionism too, or something like that. I don't think so, but it was just imagination.
Have you ever shared her, as you describe, existential pessimism?
No, I think I'm more of an optimist, actually. For me, art is about joy rather than pessimism. And when I do my writing, even if I know that it's not perfect, I know that I can go back and change it and fix it and revise. And so I'm optimistic about the process, that somehow I'm going to be able to make it better. And I guess there's so much joy in the work. This book was my greatest joy for me, apart from my family, during the time that I wrote it and even rewrote it. I could hear the voices of the characters in my head. I could see the places that I was writing about, and I could feel the whole thing coming through me. So no, I didn't have any pessimism when I was working on it.
Many of your stories have Jewish themes about them. I mean, many of the characters are Jewish. A lot of what they concern themselves with has to do with Jewish ritual and whether they should support Israel or not, and how religious their children are, and so on. And I'm wondering if you had Jewish-themed literature that spoke to you when you were growing up. I mean, some of the like classic American Jewish writers include people like, you know, Saul Bellow and Philip Roth. They're of a different generation than you are. They were writing about different times, and they're also male and not female. And I'm wondering if their writing spoke to you.
Well, when I was growing up, when I was younger, the Jewish writers that I perhaps made the most impression on me were people like Sholem Aleichem. Especially his humor influenced me a great deal in my short stories. And I remember my father used to actually read his work aloud in English. None of us knew Yiddish. And we would just laugh and laugh. And that was sort of an ideal for me, to create work in which people would just laugh and just have a wonderful time that way. Eudora Welty was sort of my other ideal of that kind of writing. And so it was much, so of course he was much older and of a different generation even than Philip Roth and Saul Bellow. I came to them much later when I was in my life. And I find their work brilliant. And I don't know if it's influenced me. I think I'm probably quite different from them in many ways. I live in a different time and I've had a very different experience. I do remember, though, reading Goodbye Columbus for the first time, and again, felt this sort of energy and this humor, and I was really, that book knocked my socks off when I first read it. So, you know, although, again, different place, different time, I felt it coming through, the energy of that work.
When you started to publish while you were in college, since you were still, you know, so comparatively young for a writer, did you worry about not having worthy subject matter?
I think maybe a little bit I did. I did a little bit. Especially because, of course, what I was studying in college was, you know, 17th century English poetry. And I wrote my senior thesis on Paradise Lost, you know. So, you know, when you compare that to the short stories that I was writing, which were light, humorous, very, very Jewish, you know, I did sort of think, you know, am I going to be a great writer? You know, this isn't great like Milton, no way. So, but again, maybe that was good for me. Maybe it was humbling and kept me in perspective.
Well, you live in Boston now, and you're married and have two sons. And I wonder how your sense of what it means to be Jewish in terms of a larger community has changed living in Boston as opposed to Hawaii.
Well, I have a sense of how much bigger the Jewish community really is. And what amazed me at first also about the Jewish community here on the mainland is the way there's so many institutions, you know, they have these palatial Jewish community centers everywhere in the suburbs and these, you know, Jewish camps and Jewish schools. And so that made a big impression on me when I first came from Hawaii and really lived here and understood that. And often I go to, I'll go give a talk at a Jewish community center and, you know, people will ask me what life was like in Hawaii as a Jewish person. And I'll say, well, we didn't have anything, you know, we didn't have a complex like this with this pool and this this banquet hall or anything like that, you know, so it was different. And also, I guess coming to the East Coast from so far away, you see some of the parochialism that can happen even in big cities where people look out from Boston or out from New York and they see a wilderness beyond there. They can't even imagine people growing up or living in a place like Hawaii, really living their lives or being Jewish in a place like Hawaii. So that became clear to me as well.
Allegra Goodman's new novel is Catterskill Falls. I'm Barbara Bogave, and this is Fresh Air.